Today on Vox Talks Economics, can COP30 get the green transition back on track? Welcome to Vox Talks Economics, coming to you from the first Hoffman Center CEPR Recipe Conference at the Geneva Graduate Institute. My name is Tim Phillips. We're fast approaching COP30, where the world will look for meaningful policy commitments. But it's not a great moment for international cooperation. So with hindsight, was the period from 2017 to 2022 a golden moment for the climate transition and an opportunity that we missed? That's the argument of Livio Straca, Deputy Director General for Financial Stability at the European Central Bank and Chair of the Network for Greening the Financial System work on climate scenarios. At the conference, we talked about what we can learn from that period, 2017 to 2022, and what can still be done at this COP to avoid what Livio calls climate agenda fatigue. Livio, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Dean, for the invite.
You referred to 2017 to 22 as a golden moment for the climate change agenda. So let's go back to 2017 and 22. Why was it a good moment for the transition? Let's talk about technology, first of all.
So in general, I would say this was the time, I mean, it was rather, you know, short after the Paris Agreement. And it was also a time when, if you believe in surveys, you know, people were most interested in the climate agenda, more concerned by climate change. Also, if you look at any type of green assets or return on green assets versus brown assets and so on, this is seems to be so far been the time of the peak of green assets compared with, say, non-green or brown assets. And by a number of measures, I think that period has been particularly favorable. But I think on the technology side, there was also still a lot of uncertainty about renewables, technology, and also what would prevail in terms of technology. I think now, in 2025, I think we can say that the solar appears to be right now the most successful technology. And I think back 5-10 years ago, it was less clear. So in terms of perhaps technological uncertainty has declined a bit now. It was a bit more open in that period.
There was a big price fall of the solar technology around that time, wasn't there?
Yeah, also a bit later because the solar, actually, I think Europe was at the frontier of technology in those times, but it has been largely transferred to China. And the Chinese producers have been able to lower the price of solar panels significantly, partly due to economies of scale and partly for other reasons. This has been, to some extent, a positive development. So on the supply side, technology side, things are not going that bad. But certainly from a demand perspective, you know, the demand for climate policies has been going down.
Yes, I wanted to talk about that. After the Paris Agreement, then we saw a lot of national commitments. Governments would commit to their policies. During that time, 2017 to 2022, we saw not universal commitments, but a lot more than we see now.
In the Paris process, countries need to communicate their climate policies to the UN. And these policies are called NDCs, so they're National Determined Contributions. Mm-hmm. And there have been essentially three waves of these contributions. So this year, in the wake of the COP30 conference in Brazil, actually the third wave of these NDCs will have to be communicated and released. And by the way, we are falling behind also that communication. But at the same time, I wouldn't say that at any point in time these NDCs were, you know, compatible with a net zero path. So there's never been the case. But, you know, in the past ways, there is some countries at least have had a bit more commitment to converge towards net zero. And I mean, the EU probably has been the large economy which has done the most, I mean, and the UK as well. They've done the most to converge towards net zero. But for other economies, it's been more like lukewarm. And in the case of the US also, there was a bit of a roller coaster with the US first withdrawing from Paris, then joining again, then leaving again this year.
The next item here is the withdrawal from the Paris Climate Treaty. We're going to save over $1 trillion by withdrawing from that treaty.
But without much actual change in climate policies. There was a lot of announcement, a lot of communication, but if you look at US climate policies, they've not really changed that much. That's also interesting.
Yeah, well, there were some interesting figures that you show about public support the climate change agenda. It's never been universally popular, but during that time, 2017-22, the public awareness and general support for it was pretty good.
Yeah. So here, I think we have to distinguish two dimensions, two aspects. So one is, so if you ask people, are you in favor or against the climate policy? We still have a quite good majority in most countries in favor.
Yeah.
So if you ask yes or no, people will say yes. But then if you put the question differently, you say, you know, what is the problem that is bothering you the most? Climate change doesn't tend to come up now. So it tend to come up more 5-10 years ago. Now, other problems have overshadowed climate change. I mean, if I look at Europe, in most Central and Eastern Europe, defense and the Russian threat is the number one now. In the south of Europe, is more the cost of living, inflation. So when you actually ask people what is the problem that is pressing you the most, actually only Sweden, which is a paradox because Sweden even benefits maybe from climate change, but so only in Sweden we find, according to the latest data, that is the problem number one. Measured is the problem number one, but in all other countries, other things have taken over. So it's more a question of attention. It's just not at the top of the list in surveys. And this is rather extreme in the United States. In the United States, I show some data on concerns that voters have expressed during the presidential elections, and climate change counts, I think, at position 21. So clearly there is a long list of things, you know, before that.
Other things they would like to see fixed first.
Right.
Yes.
I think the US is a bit extreme in that, but there's been a deeper general tendency in many countries. So it depends. I mean, it's both good news and bad news. I mean, the good news is there is still, I think, a constituency in favor of continued climate policies. But the bad news is that they need to be woken up a bit. They need to be reactivated.
If you want to know more about what the Network for Greening the Financial System does and how it does it, we recently spoke to Frank Elderson, who was its first chair. In December 2024, he told us about the work of the NGFS, and we also spoke about the limits of monetary policy in addressing the problems of climate change. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts to listen to our episode, Can Central Banks Green the Financial System?
Also during that time, that golden moment, private finance started to invest in the technology transition and set up institutions that would help to move that along. That was a big step forward.
Yes. So if we speak about inflows into what you could call green assets, which of course is a very nuanced definition, of course.
Yes. Yeah.
But if you look at data on inflows into, say, ESG compliant bond and equity funds, you certainly see a peak. Actually, as I show in my presentation, the inflow into bonds, into ESG bonds, has continued to be positive. I mean, not very strong, but positive.
Mm-hmm.
What we have seen is a retreat from equity funds. So these sustainability oriented equity funds. And overall, I think we have seen, generally speaking, a large fall in green equity prices. You can call it ESG or you can call it sustainability-oriented asset prices. And this is as a number of reasons. Partly is a perception of future policy. Markets thrive on expectations or because of work based on expectation. But it's also true that, you know, interest rates play a big role. I mean, this period has also been a period of very low interest rates or zero interest rates. And in particular, the renewable sector is very capital intensive. So low interest really help. But then the higher interest rates have really put a brake on the sector. So the renewables have really been hit. So it's a bit hard to disentangle the role of interest rates and other factors from the pure, say, preference towards sustainable. All factors combined. I'm not aware a study really has disentangled these different components. And interesting, we have seen also a revival now in the last few months of these ESG funds. I myself hold some of these ESG funds, and I was a bit desperate because they were going down and down. And,
yes,
you know, I'd be happy to see that there was a significant rebound recently. And this rebound partly also reflects also lower interest rates again. So the identification of the purely climate factor is complicated.
You and me both on holding those ESG funds, Livia. If we're going to think about that golden moment as an opportunity missed in some ways, did we underinvest in some of the important technologies at that time?
So I would say probably if you look at Europe, the solar industry, or at least I would say, so there should be some kind of post-mortem analysis of why Europe largely lost the solar industry and why it moved to China. So I don't think that this history has been fully written. I mean, industrial policy may be part of the answer. Scale is another part of the answer. For the solar specifically, there is a question of more geography. Is Europe, US or China the place where the scale production takes place? If I remember correctly, the Draghi report, solar is mentioned as something that Europe should more or less consider gone. It would be very hard to get it back because of the scale effects, introduction to scale. So in that meaning, I guess, the supply side decisions have been very important, and I don't think that we have built enough capacity in key sectors.
We're very much more conscious about what we would consider enabling technologies, things like investment in the grid now, aren't we? Could we have foreseen that those investments would be as important as we now know they are?
Maybe, yeah, I agree. I mean, also the blackout and so on. I mean, so we have, you know, experience exposed, but of course, these decisions are forward-looking based on expectations and at the time. If you speak about a lost moment in that time, what I would single out more, however, is really the lack of a mechanism that really, in terms of international cooperation, really puts these efforts on almost on an autopilot. That was the best moment to try to do that. It has been all left to national politics, and this in the US in particular, but a bit everywhere, of course, is very, very amenable to backlash.
That backlash now is advocating more fossil fuel extraction, which is something that you and me in 2017 would not have predicted that.
I agree. There's been also a bit of, of excess on the side of the, you know, pro-climate agenda, you know, to argue that fossil fuels could be completely discontinued in the NGFS scenarios. So this work from the Network for Greening the Financial Systems, we have long-term scenarios for climate. And even in those scenarios, even the most optimistic scenarios, you know, fossil fuels don't go to zero. So that we always have some fossil fuels. So it's not that they will disappear, but of course, you know, it's crucial to reduce them if you want to achieve any kind of net zero target. And indeed, the production of oil and gas has proved to be very resilient, unfortunately, even though U.S. oil production, there's been no boom this year, for example. So also there, the U.S. administration had promised a big boom in oil and gas production. And according to the data I have, I don't see that boom. So it has remained high. The U.S. is producing a lot of oil, but is not higher than it was under the previous administration, for example. So it's quite stable.
Yeah, in those cases, we can argue that the rhetoric is ahead of the action. In private finance, where these alliances, these ambitious net zero alliances were set up, then we have seen action, specifically withdrawals from them, haven't we?
Yeah, so this is also another worrying aspect that both on the government side, we have seen, of course, the U.S. withdrawing from the Paris Agreement, but also from the NGFS, but also in particular US banks also withdrawing from net zero alliances. I'm not sure how much this really matters, because part of these commitments were also a bit rhetorical and more like signaling virtue, but of course it's still not a good sign. And in particular, the large banks and bank funding in the end remains the most important for the economy. So what banks do, you know, matters.
So we're at a moment now of, on the one hand, climate agenda fatigue, both from citizens and, we could argue, in private finance, and we could even argue for some governments, but a very important moment to get that agenda back on track. If we're to look at those opportunities missed during that golden moment and think, what can we learn from them? What do we learn?
We already knew, but we must relearn, I guess, that public mood is volatile. And I'm quite struck by this idea that even though the attitude has not changed dramatically, the weight given to different problems has changed. I think we should always think that this is, you know, may happen to any issue. The same issue with, say, nuclear war. I mean, the objective risk of nuclear war is not lower than before, but people don't think about it anymore. I mean, if you ask them, of course, you want or not nuclear war, everybody will say, no, I don't want it. But people don't think about it. So, you know, this partly the same, less dramatically, but partly is happening also with climate. So I think we should find ways to separate a bit this agenda from the vagaries of public opinion. The risk, of course, is that it loses legitimacy. These are decisions with political distributional consequences, but it needs to be put on a more long-term basis. I don't say outside of public control, of course, but at least outside of the short-term variations in public opinion. But another important aspect, is that the bulk of emissions is concentrated in less than 10 countries. So it's right to treat climate policy as a global public good or international commitment and so on. But, you know, de facto, there are 5 to 6 countries where these matter. And these are, of course, as you can imagine, the US, China, India, European Union. So even though the whole world obviously needs to participate, needs to be a collective effort, you know, it is a global issue, obviously. But these countries and the internal politics of those countries, you know, matter disproportionately. And so that's why I think we need to find a way to, I would say, not go to the extreme of taking this away from the voters, but at least taking it away from short-term changes on mine, because it's too important an agenda. In my role as in the NGFS...
Your role in the NGFS is what?
So the NGFS is a network for greening the financial system. So it's an alliance of central banks and supervisors to, I would say, consider climate change and climate in regulation and supervision, I would say. And so in doing this work, we have a big work stream on producing climate scenarios. And these climate scenarios are very well recognized and widely used both by supervisors and also by private financial institutions. So the NGFS has become a bit of a catalyst for this. And in particular, I would say at the intersection between climate and the economy and the macroeconomies. So in this role, of course, we receive feedback on both sides. So according to some, we are too alarmistic. We have a big discussion now on a relationship which is called the damage function. So basically how climate change affects GDP, which is called in the literature the damage function. And so some argue that the damage function is too pessimistic, that we are overestimating the effect of climate change on GDP, on the economy. We also receive a lot of feedback from activists of various types. I think it's very difficult to keep a bit of a balanced perspective between these two extremes. And climate, unfortunately, is an era where you either think the world is ending or you think it's a complete hoax. I found it's quite hard to find people between the middle that think it's a relevant issue. We need to manage it, but the world is not collapsing. So it's this conversation has been a bit absent.
We've spoken a lot today about the things that have gone wrong from your work on those climate scenarios. What optimism can you draw about the policies that are on track and the potential to meet our net zero goals?
No, thanks for the question. It's very important also to be a bit positive. So I think on the supply side, you know, things are moving in the right direction. The solar industry is booming. I think it's still possible to have a constellation where energy, in particular electricity, but perhaps even energy overall, is produced using renewables, in particular solar, in a relatively short time, and crucially, without increasing the cost of energy. What is very important also is not to increase the cost of energy. The answer should not be in consuming less or less energy, but it should be a more technological problem. Let's change the way we produce energy and let's change the technology, but with the objective, at least the intention, to produce energy at the same cost or even lower cost. And I think that there is a good possibility that this could happen. I mean, this is also intersects a bit with the big investment that are required in AI, for example. So we need cheap energy, possibly to invest in AI, which is very energy intensive. So the promise is perhaps that in the future we'll have a combination of AI and cheap energy that really powers the world economy and we could get in a much better place. Also, let's not forget, and there is a large issue on this, that oil and gas extraction is detrimental for the quality of government institution within producing countries. So often these countries become predatory and so on. The rule of law is not respected. But on the other hand, of course, you know, the importing countries are also subject to blackmail, or at least by subject to shocks coming from exporting countries. We have seen that in the case of Russia, obviously. So also in terms of geopolitical stability, that countries having more domestic production and renewables can be more domestically produced. There are still some dependencies, for example, in the era of raw materials. I mean, you still need a lot of copper, a lot of lithium to produce energy using renewables. So it's not completely solved, but hopefully there is a decline in how countries are reliant on energy exporters, or maybe it's more diversified. So also from a geopolitical point of view, this could be also an advantage that we move to a kind of a less tense world in that respect. I think we should nurture and cultivate this vision of the future and think a bit also long term. Also, be a bit reassured by the fact that in this issue, there is a lot of inertia. Despite the rhetoric, even in the US, I don't expect a big actual change in climate policy because of these inertial factors.
Livio, thank you very much for giving your vision of the future.
Thank you, Tim. It was a pleasure.
If
If you want to know more about the Network for Greening the Financial System scenarios, you can find them at ngfs.net.
Vox Talks Economics is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber, and our editor is Andrei Zagarian. Next week on Vox Talks Economics, Sarpata Dasgupta on the economics of biodiversity.